In today's episode of Dietitians Only, clinical dietitians Sarah and Emily tackle the common yet challenging condition of gastroparesis. They'll dive into the details of the condition and share how nutrition management takes center stage. You're listening to Dietitians Only, a podcast from Dietitians on Demand, created by dietitians for dietitians. Let's get into it.
Hey everyone, welcome back to Dietitians Only. This is Sarah Glantz, Director of Clinical Education here at Dietitians on Demand. And we have a special guest today, Emily Menez. She is the client relations specialist on our corporate team, and she also has a background in clinical nutrition. So Emily, welcome. And do you want to take a minute to tell us a little bit about your background in clinical nutrition?
Of course. Thanks for having me. So I'm relatively new to the Dietitians on Demand team, and I come from working in a relatively big health system in GI and transplant for about 5+ years. So I dealt with gastroparesis on a pretty regular basis, and I'm excited to talk to you guys about it today.
All right. Well, we're happy to have you. So let's start by talking a little bit about what gastroparesis is.
Yeah. So if you just look at the name for gastroparesis, it basically defines it for you. So gastro meaning stomach, paresis meaning partial paralysis. It's basically going to be a condition that is affecting gastric motility and digestion, which is going to delay the stomach's ability to empty food in a timely fashion.
Okay, so I imagine that could cause some problems. So what are some of the signs and symptoms that we usually see alongside gastroparesis?
So as expected, if you have food sitting in your stomach for prolonged amounts of time, a patient is going to experience nausea, vomiting, fullness, early satiety, abdominal pain that can range from mild to severe. And these all can ultimately lead to weight loss and potentially malnutrition.
Right. So it makes sense that if you're feeling bad all the time, you're probably not eating as much, or if you're losing some of it, you know, if you're vomiting a lot.
Exactly.
Makes sense. So it sounds like there's a lot of nutrition issues at play here. So what are some of the causes, the common causes of gastroparesis?
So probably the most common cause of gastroparesis that you'll see in clinical care is going to be diabetes, and mostly uncontrolled diabetes. So just like with any other uncontrolled diabetes patient, you're going to see issues within the nerves of the body. So that can also happen in the nerves of the stomach, which is going to affect the stomach's ability to pass food properly. But other causes can be surgical, particularly if the vagus nerve is damaged during a GI surgery. Also neurological disorders, certain medications that slow down motility like narcotics. And then there's going to be a fair amount that are idiopathic or without a clear cause.
Okay. So imagine that can be frustrating when you are having all these symptoms, when you don't have a cause. So that's a bummer.
Yeah. I think patients are just excited to know that their feelings are validated and they have some physiological reason for feeling so poorly. But the idiopathic population is definitely an interesting one.
Yeah, I'm sure. So regardless of the cause, we have to manage it in some way. So can you tell us a little bit about the nutrition management of gastroparesis, what dietitians really should know about it?
Of course. So, you know, with gastroparesis, most of the nutrition management is going to be treating and managing symptoms. So with most of our nutrition interventions with any disease, our first line is always going to be oral diet restrictions. So making sure that we're limiting foods that might potentially further slow down gastric motility. So from an oral diet perspective, avoiding high fat and high fiber foods, aiming for small frequent meals just to not overload the stomach with a large volume at one time. Sometimes alternating liquids and solid intake just to not fill up the stomach at one time and make sure you're getting enough nutrition in. And in some cases, patients might tolerate liquids or solids better. So kind of, you know, evaluating which might be doing better and optimizing one over the other just to make sure they're getting enough nutrition in through those meals.
Gotcha. Now, when you say alternating liquids and solids, does that mean like not drinking while you're eating a meal?
Yeah. So, you know, given the fact that liquids in general don't tend to have much nutrition, we want to make sure that every bit counts that's coming in. So if somebody is going to either drink 8 ounces of water or be able to get 8 ounces of protein in, we want to make sure that they're getting the most bang for their buck.
Yeah, that makes sense. And so what about if oral diet modifications alone are not really cutting it? So if patients still having a lot of nausea, vomiting, maybe they're still losing weight, where do we go from here?
So, you know, the first step would be to see if oral nutrition supplements or any sort of, you know, supplemental nutrition can be added by mouth. If that can't, you know, make it happen just because, you know, they're vomiting constantly or they're nauseous all the time and can't keep anything down, then that might be when you need to have the discussion with your patient that we may need to trial enteral nutrition.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So with enteral nutrition, is this a situation like that patients can continue to eat, like they should continue to eat, or should it be more of eating is not working, let's just get on a feeding tube?
So, I mean, I think, you know, it's not a one size fits all for patients. So it kind of depends on your patient. You want to make sure that you're meeting them where they're at. So if it's someone who just has intermittent times where they need a little extra support when they're having a flare up of symptoms, you know, they might just need it for like a week just to, until things ease down and then they can, you know, go back to eating an oral diet. Or it might be someone who just completely cannot do anything by mouth anymore and needs to be on something more long-term.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what about types of tubes or locations? Like, are we talking gastric feeding? Are we talking about intestinal feeding? Are we talking about permanent tubes or temporary?
So the best mode of action would be to first place a temporary tube just to make sure that your patient can tolerate tube feeds in general, because there might be, you know, global dysmotility as well, that food is not even getting to the point of the lower GI tract to even know if the patient tolerates it because they are vomiting so often. So, you know, getting a nasal intestinal tube would be the first line, just to make sure they can tolerate their regimen for about, you know, a few days to a week or a couple of weeks before putting them through a more invasive procedure to get that permanent tube placed.
Gastroparesis is one of those things that is common yet challenging to manage. Add our gastroparesis resources to your collection and you won't be caught unprepared. Visit shop.dietitiansondemand.com and type gastro into the search bar to find everything you need.
With a nasointestinal tube, is that something that patients can sometimes go home with, if even if it is just temporary? Do you see that ever?
Yeah, I mean, it kind of depends. So if you have a patient that has not been eating well for some time and they're going to be at risk for refeeding syndrome, that's somebody that you would want to monitor closely as you're introducing nutrition back into the system. So for someone like that, you would want to admit them to monitor their electrolytes closely and potentially could schedule their long-term tube placement during that same admission if they were able to tolerate feeds. But, you know, if it's someone who has been able to kind of meet a minimum where they're not as at risk for refeeding, they can go home with the tube. It sometimes can be challenging, especially with patients who are vomiting often, because I have had patients who have vomited up their nasointestinal tube, which is also a little traumatizing for patients. Mm-hmm. And if that happens, they will likely not want to have it replaced.
Sure. Understandable. So
in that case, if they are at least able to tolerate some, that's usually enough to move forward. But we basically are just trying to avoid them from going through a more invasive procedure. You know, we don't want them to not tolerate after all of that.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. And then I have seen sometimes a GJ, which I've also seen called MOS tubes before. So can you tell us a little bit about that and their role when it comes to gastroparesis?
So, you know, a GJ tube is typically going to be the best line for a gastroparetic patient, just because the G tube is very helpful with, if the patient is having a lot of nausea and vomiting, they can use that tube to vent and, you know, let out secretions or potentially eat for comfort and then vent out the food that they ate, just to not cause further symptoms. But in some cases, you know, with gastroparesis, there are some patients that also have Ehlers-Danlos, which can, affect the tube and it flipping out of the stomach into out of the intestine into the stomach. So that can be challenging for the feeding portion that is in the jejunum.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, what exactly is that condition? Not that we want to get on a tangent.
Yeah, we don't want to go on a whole other tangent, but Ehlers-Danlos is a group of inherited disorders that essentially affect your strength and elasticity of different tissues in your body. And, you know, it is sometimes seen pretty commonly with gastroparesis or, you know, other disease states that are affecting dysmotility. So it can affect, you know, the stomach and intestines as far as the strength and elasticity, which can make the tube potentially flip up more easily from the intestine into the stomach.
Okay, well, good. That was a good mini tangent. I think it's worthwhile. So what about when you are selecting a formula? Because there are lots of different formulas out there, and there may be some confusion about what these patients actually need and don't need. So can you share any shed any light on that?
Yeah. So, you know, with us feeding past the stomach, you know, you shouldn't have to worry about the same dietary restrictions that we think about when you're, you know, utilizing the stomach and eating orally. That being said, with us feeding the intestines, sometimes the intestines are a little bit more sensitive. And sometimes these patients are also at risk for having motility issues throughout their GI tract. So I would typically still aim for a moderate to low fat and fiber formula, just to not further worsen any sort of motility issues in the intestines, especially because fat and fiber can also affect the osmolality of formulas. And we all know with feeding the intestines, that can sometimes cause more diarrhea and discomfort and bloating. So just keeping in mind, you know, your patient and assessing their symptoms as you're introducing a formula. But in theory, you can really use any, you know, standard formula to start. You would want to keep in mind, though, if your ideology of gastroparesis is related to diabetes, you would want to aim for a lower carbohydrate formula.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that makes sense. So you mentioned starting with a standard formula. And of course, there are other formulas that are partially broken down, things like that. So you're saying start with standard. If that doesn't work, then maybe consider like the partially hydrolyzed and all that.
Yeah, I think, you know, when we're looking at formulas, the kind of standard of care in general is to kind of start with what mimics food the closest and then go, you know, more broken down as needed. And, you know, anytime you are moving towards a more elemental formula, you run the risk of having the osmolality being higher as well, which again can cause, you know, rapid intestinal transit and potentially your patient might have more diarrhea, which we don't want that.
No. And also, I mean, just from a cost perspective, usually standard formulas, I mean, especially if it's going to be paid through insurance, many times they require at least a trial of a standard formula and documentation of failure. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, we can debate that another time, but like usually that's just the way it works. And so,
definitely.
Know.
Yeah. And the other thing to keep in mind while we're on the insurance tangent is that sometimes, especially with gastroparesis, insurance companies really love extremes. So they sometimes don't want your patient to be eating and on tube feeding. Mm-hmm. So sometimes that's something you have to consider as well. You know, if it's someone who needs to be fully sole source of nutrition on tube feeds, or if, you know, the insurance might be a little bit trickier if they're also eating by mouth.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Thank goodness for case managers and social workers.
Yep. Yep.
And then what about parenteral nutrition? Does that have a role at all? Or can we typically manage these patients with just either oral diet or tube feeding?
They should be able to be managed with oral nutrition or tube feeding. I mean, you should really only consider parenteral nutrition if there's, you know, no way to utilize the GI tract. So kind of your standard acute reasons of why you would be using parenteral nutrition. So like a small bowel obstruction, loss of safe enteral access, you know, anything like that, totally appropriate, but you should likely not go straight from oral diet to TPN for a gastroparesis patient.
Makes sense. And then just to touch briefly, there are some medications, right, that are out there that are often used in conjunction with diet modifications or enteral nutrition or what have you. Mm-hmm. So, you know, likely your patient will be on some kind of medication too, right?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Most of these patients are going to be on a pro-motility agent. So
metoclopramide.
There you go. Reglan.
That's like my life achievement there, is learning how to say that word.
Exactly. You know, I tried it so many times too before this podcast, be like, you need to know how to say it. But Reglan
yes.
is also another name for it.
Commonly known as Reglan.
So that most of your patients are going to be on that. But it can also sometimes cause diarrhea. So, you know, it's picking the lesser of two evils.
Yeah, it sounds like a real balancing act when it comes to gastroparesis. And like you said, there are times when things are great and you're eating and life is good. And then there are other times when you have a flare and things are not so good. So it's a roller coaster, I'm sure.
Yes, it definitely is.
Yeah. Well, thank you. This has been really helpful. I think it's given dietitians a lot of good practical information. So I think we'll wrap it up for today. And I want to thank Emily for being with us and sharing her expertise. You may just hear her again on a future episode. You never know. But she's like a podcast guru now.
Watch out.
So with that, just we're going to sign off and say thank you again for listening. And we hope to see you again or hear you or maybe listen, whatever. Hope you can join us again soon in the future.
Thanks for listening to Dietitians Only, a podcast produced by Dietitians On Demand. If you need a break today, scroll over to the review section of the podcast and leave us one. Your feedback is the best way to help the podcast grow. Dietitians On Demand employs hundreds of dietitians nationwide and elevates the profession with simple yet effective practice resources, like this podcast. Don't forget to stay connected with us on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Instagram. The information in this podcast is not intended or implied to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. All content is for general information purposes only. You are encouraged to confirm any information obtained from or through this podcast with other sources and review all information regarding any medical condition or treatment. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay seeking medical treatment because of something you heard in this podcast.